Welcome to the Hinckley Institute of Politics. My name is Emily, and I'll be the host for today's Hinckley Forum. The Hinckley Institute was established in 1965 through the generous bequest of the Noble Foundation and Robert H. Hinckley. The Institute is dedicated to teaching students respect for practical politics and the principle of citizen involvement in government. The Hinckley Institute offers paid internships to students of all majors here locally in Washington, D.C., and in 35 countries around the globe. The Hinckley Institute also offers classes, the nation's only campaign management minor, week-long experiences to Washington, D.C., and over $300,000 in academic scholarships. We invite students to go next door or to visit our website, www.hinckley.utah.edu, for more information. The title of today's forum is Pursuing Peace, Healing 9/11. And now I'd like to turn the time over to Tom Maloney, Chair of the University of Utah's Economics Department and Director of the Tanner Center for Human Rights, who will introduce today's guest, Ann Wright.
Thanks very much. It's my great privilege to welcome you to this forum featuring Ann Wright. Today's event is part of a series of lectures that's been organized by a group called the Peace Advocacy Coalition. And the series is entitled Healing 9/11. And its main purpose is to examine a variety of changes in national policy and political climate in the years since the 9/11 attacks and to reflect on how the many wounds of this era might be healed through politics and policy and community action. And a full schedule of those events can be found at the Tanner Center website, humanrights.utah.edu. as well as at the Peace Advocacy Coalition website and Facebook page. And the Tanner Center for Human Rights is just one collaborator in this series, and so I want to recognize the hard work and the financial support of a number of other groups, some university groups, some community groups, including the Gandhi Alliance for Peace, the College of Social Work here at the U, Veterans for Peace, who have been very involved in Ann Wright's visit, the Peace and Justice Studies Program at Utah Valley University, Salt Lake Community College, the School of Humanities and Social Sciences there, Utahns for Just Peace in the Holy Land, the Wasatch Coalition for Peace and Justice, the Honors Program, and the Women and Gender Studies programs at Weber State, and also Westminster College. Ann Wright, our guest today, grew up in Bentonville, Arkansas, and attended the University of Arkansas. She spent 13 years in the U.S. Army and 16 additional years in the Reserves and retired as a colonel. In 1987, she joined the Foreign Service and served as a U.S. Deputy Ambassador in Sierra Leone, Micronesia, Afghanistan, and Mongolia. She received the State Department's Award for Heroism for her actions during the evacuation of 2,500 people from the Civil War in Sierra Leone. She was on the first State Department team to go to Afghanistan and helped reopen the embassy there in December 2001. On March 19, 2003, on the eve of the U.S. invasion of Iraq, Ann Wright resigned her position with the State Department in protest of the invasion. Since then, she's been writing and speaking on matters related to post-9/11 policy, but also on Israel's policy with regard to Palestine and on many other controversies where peace and justice are at stake. She'll speak tomorrow at 10 o'clock at Salt Lake Community College on pursuing peace after 9/11, and at 7 p.m. tomorrow night at the downtown library on working for justice for the Palestinians. This morning, however, she's going to be discussing a different history and a different conflict. The title of her talk is The U.S. and Vietnam, From War to Peace. Please join me in welcoming Ann Wright.
Thank you. Thanks, Tom. Well, thank you very much, Tom, and thank you, Emily. It's a pleasure to be here at the University of Utah and the Hinckley Institute for Politics, and I was struck by some of the things you mentioned that the Institute does in this course or major minor in campaign management. Ooh, well, that is really an interesting one, and with the electoral season coming into swing right now, I imagine that course is well subscribe to. As Tom mentioned, the overall theme for my presence here is, and what was it? Peace, recover, no, healing. Make healing peace after 9/11. Well, you know, that's a real interesting topic, isn't it? Healing and peace. I would almost say it's more recovering. And healing from 9/11, recovering from 9/11, is really, I think, and maybe an even more descriptive way to talk about what we are dealing with right now. You know, how long ago was it? 13 years ago, 12 and a half years ago. Our nation was turned on its head with the horrible events of 9/11, with 3,000 Americans and other nationalities that were killed in those four plane crashes, and the things that have happened to us in the name of our national security. I myself, as you've heard, have spent my whole life in national security issues, from the 29 years that I spent in the U.S. military, in the Army and active duty and Army reserves, and then the 16 years that I spent in the U.S. Diplomatic Corps, the U.S. State Department. And not only did I serve in the countries that Tom mentioned, but I also served in Nicaragua, Grenada, Somalia, Uzbekistan, Kyrgyzstan, Sierra Leone, Micronesia. I did help reopen the U.S. Embassy in Kabul, Afghanistan, that had been closed 12 years before. We reopened that in December of 2001, just 3 months after 9/11. And then I was the deputy ambassador in Mongolia. And it was in Mongolia where, in March of 11 years ago, I resigned. I resigned in opposition of the Bush administration's decision to invade and occupy Iraq, an oil-rich Arab Muslim country that had nothing to do with 9/11. And as a longtime person in the government, and having been through 8 different presidential administrations, starting with Lyndon Johnson during the Vietnam War. That's when I joined the military. I joined during the Vietnam War. And if you think of all the things that happened from the Vietnam War onward, the presidents that we had and the policies that they were pursuing, there were many people of our country during that period of time that totally disagreed with the policies of the various presidents. I mean, if we had an older audience, and this is wonderful, that the audience is in, we've got some older folks, but we've got a lot of good students here, and that's wonderful. Thank you all so much for being here. And thanks to the people from the community that are here that are my age and who were, while I was in the government, they were out protesting the policies that I was helping implement. In fact, let me just ask, how many of you all were on the streets? When I was in the Army in Vietnam, how many of you all were on the streets saying, hell no, don't go? Yeah, virtually all of them. And how many of you all were on the streets during the Reagan administration in the U.S. wars of Central America? There we go. How many of you all were on the streets saying this idea of invading and occupying Iraq is not a very good idea? Yeah, so while I was in the government, you all were out challenging the government. And now I have joined you because 11 years ago when I resigned from the government, I was one of only 3 people that resigned over the Iraq War, three federal employees. That's all it was. It wasn't like there was a wholesale walkout of government employees over the war, and generally there aren't wholesale walkouts. As people make their decisions on what kind of careers they want in life, and I had decided that I wanted to be a career government employee, I wanted to make sure that I had a pension at the end of my working days. I mean, that's pretty crass, isn't it? That's one of your goals. Except how many of you all kind of would like to have something to rely on when you have worked for 30 or 40 years? You'd like to kind of have something you can rely on. Anybody that doesn't want that? No. So I made my decision. I felt that probably the last institution to go under financially was the U.S. government, and that would be a good place to work. Little did we know, you know, that the U.S. government would be so severely in debt right now, but at least it's still paying its employees. But that's how I kind of got into the government and stayed in while you all were protesting it, many of its policies. So here I find myself now after 9/11, And having been to Afghanistan right after 9/11 and have spent 6 months there to see what the U.S. government was, what we were going to be doing in Afghanistan, and seeing that very quickly that the U.S., the focus of Washington had turned from Afghanistan, where the Al-Qaeda group and Osama bin Laden were located. They had switched their focus someplace else, and that turned out to be to Iraq. And having then decided I could not be a part of that huge policy for the United States to invade and occupy Iraq, I resigned. I resigned and sent a letter of resignation to Colin Powell, a long letter of resignation. I figured since I'd been in the government for nearly 40 years, they could at least read one page for every decade I'd been in government service. So I let them have it on all fronts, not only the war in Iraq, but the unnecessary curtailment of civil liberties after 9/11. And you think about recovering from 9/11, healing from 9/11. What are those things that have happened to us after 9/11? Is our society a very different society from what it was before 9/11? And if you look at the things that our government has told us they needed to do, it needed to do on our behalf to ensure our national security, there are things that I have great concerns about. And one of them was the Patriot Act that really curtailed a lot of the civil liberties that we have. And we thought the Patriot Act was terrible back in 2002, but boy, now we see 10 years later other things that our government has done because of 9/11, because of our national security. You look now at what we are facing, the revelations that have come about the eavesdropping that our government is doing on us, the wholesale scooping up of all the information that we have about our private lives that we sometimes share with other people through communications, some with our cell phone, with our home phones, with our computers. And now that we know through the revelations of Ed Snowden, a whistleblower now in Moscow, an NSA employee, that every single thing that we communicate with is now being tracked by our government. And the information is being stored. And for you all here in Utah, it's being stored very close to you. Just apparently just, 15, 20, 30 miles south of here. And the largest computer, they say, in the world now is now warehousing all of the communications that we do on our cell phones. Our emails are being tracked. But don't worry. Don't worry now, our president says. We aren't going to be looking into that until we need to. Until we need to. Now, who needs to do that? And why do they need to do it? That's my concern. I mean, I think most of us here would say, well, I'm not doing anything illegal. But do they, why should they warehouse this stuff to look in on what I am doing whenever they want to? What they say is illegal now, is it really illegal? Or things that are going on now, are they going to in the future say, well, that was, you were breaking laws? Or we need to find out what you were doing because we have suspicions about you. I mean, right now, what we are facing as a legacy after 9/11 is the fact that all of you all can be identified as being in this room at this hour by your cell phones. Your GPS is telling the big computer system that you're sitting right here in the Hinckley Institute of Politics, that at 10:45 on this day, you have been in the presence of Ann Wright. And you know that Ann Wright. She talks trash about what some of these government policies are, and why were you sitting there? Why were you listening to her? And they're able to call you up. They know now what the cell number was. They know that what email that you have. And so they may just call you up and say, well, why were you there? Why were you listening? Well, I was just there. I'm a student, you know. Well, you were there, and the person sitting three rows back from you was there. And, you know, that person we're very interested in. Do you know anything about that person? Do you know? Were you in any other classes with that person? Were you? I mean, this is, it's kind of makes your stomach churn, doesn't it? These things of what we're facing as the results of 9/11. the topic that really that I want to focus on that kind of goes into this a bit is, how do you recover from things like this? How do you urge your government to do work in different ways? How do you get it to focus on things that that preserve our national security but that don't undercut the liberties that we ourselves have? And one aspect is looking back at history. Some of our politicians say we want to look forward, not backward. I believe that was what President Obama said about what was going on in the Bush administration. So he's looking forward, not looking at what happened during the Bush administration of extraordinary rendition, kidnapping, warehousing of people in Guantanamo, torture. He's looking forward now. Under his administration, we have assassin drones. We have the killing of Americans by assassin drones, execution, extrajudicial execution. We have the extraordinary eavesdropping that has been successively getting worse from the Bush administration right on through the Obama administration. But I think it's wise for us as citizens, we need to look backwards. We need to look at history. We need to see what's been going on. And I just returned from a trip to Vietnam, and that's what I want to kind of bring into this discussion for us today is, what about these wars that America has been involved in? And what about has citizen involvement and protest to end wars and trying to hold the government accountable, has that worked? Has it been something that we should really value in our history and our lives? And, you know, the Vietnam War, next year in 2015, we'll be commemorating the 40th anniversary of the peace accords for Vietnam. 1975 is when the war on Vietnam by the United States was brought to an official end. The war actually started, for the United States, back in the 50s. Actually, while the French were still in Vietnam, the U.S. was sending military advisors in, and our president at the time, Dwight Eisenhower, is quoted as saying, well, we need to support the French because the French are guaranteeing the resources that we need, the resources of tin and tungsten. Eisenhower is also the one that warned us about the military-industrial complex that really started moving in great and huge leaps and bounds with the war in Vietnam as it kept getting larger and larger and larger. And it was under President Kennedy that we started sending large numbers of military advisors into the South Vietnam government. That was after the United States and the Western powers made the decision that Vietnam was not going to be a united country, that it was the West that divided North and South Vietnam, that said that there should not be elections over the entire country because they kind of suspected that the leader of the northern area, Ho Chi Minh, probably was going to win the national election. And because of that, the Western power said, no, we'll divide the country, thank you very much. And they divided it north and south. And the southern part of it was being ruled by a dictator, Diem, who was a great friend of the United States. So the United States was there to support the Diem government that was had Vietnamese that were challenging the Diem government. And they were called the Viet Cong. In the north was the Northern Vietnamese Army. Some of these things are kind of parallel to what we've heard about in other places. I mean, you think about what's going on right now and in North Korea, another divided country, North and South Korea. And the same thing happened there, that the reason that place was divided is because the North, it looked like during an election, was going to win an election, and the West decided, let's split that place up. Now Vietnam, I mean, here it is, 40 years later after the peace accords, and Have any of you all traveled to Vietnam? Our enemy, Vietnam? Two people, three people have. Have you traveled there in the last 10 years or so? Those that have traveled in the last 10 years, would you say that the people of Vietnam consider us their enemy? No. It was really amazing. I hadn't been to Vietnam in quite a long period of time, and I did not serve in the military in Vietnam, although I'm a Vietnam-era veteran. It was really remarkable to see how the Vietnamese, who had over 4 million people killed during that war, 4 million Vietnamese. The United States, we had 55,000 Americans that were killed, but there were 4 million Vietnamese that were killed. And there are over 3 million Vietnamese that now are suffering, here it is, 40 years, 45 years, 50 years later in some instances, after the United States carpet sprayed much of the country with Agent Orange to defoliate it. Here it is 3 generations later, and over 3 million Vietnamese are still being affected by this Agent Orange, the dioxin, the poisoning from that. And Vietnamese are still being blown up by ordnance that the United States dropped on Vietnam. And ordnance that we have to acknowledge, ordnance that the Viet Cong and the North Vietnamese Army had sent into their own land to fight a foreign invader on one level. The numbers of people that have been harmed by, that have been killed or maimed by all this unexploded ordnance that's left in Vietnam is astounding. You know, the United States dropped more bombs on the little tiny country of Vietnam, more bombs than were dropped during all of World War II in Europe. Now, that's a pretty staggering figure, isn't it? And yet, when you go to Vietnam, the Vietnamese welcome you. I went with a group called Veterans for Peace. We are a group of military, U.S. military veterans who have served our country through the military. Many of them have been in combat for the United States and now say, we as military veterans say there's a better way to resolving problems than war. So Veterans for Peace took a delegation. This is the third delegation, third year that we've had a delegation that's gone to Vietnam. And we met with victims of Agent Orange, families of kids that 3 generations later are showing the effects of Agent Orange. We met with people who have been maimed by unexploded ordnance, or family members that have been killed by unexploded ordnance. We met with members of the Vietnamese military, veterans of the Vietnamese military that were the enemy of the United States military. And yet, during all of these meetings, we did not find one person that came up to us and said, you shouldn't be here, get out of our country, we hate you for what you did to our country. We didn't find any of that at all. In fact, the people that we talked with were saying, we're glad you're here. We're glad that you are here. We forgive you for what you did to our country. Now, that's pretty remarkable, isn't it? 4 million people killed, and yet they are saying, we forgive you for what you did to us. And I wonder what is it, do we have that capability in our own society, in our own American society? Can we ever say we forgive people? I mean, there aren't too many times where America is on the receiving end of something. 9/11 is one of them, though. You know, 3,000 Americans killed. Most of the time, we're on the other end of the stick. Our government is saying we need to invade and occupy other countries. This time it happened on American soil. But here it is 13 years later. Are we willing to forgive anyone? Are we willing to look at why those 19 people got in the aircrafts and ran into buildings and killed 3,000 people? Are we willing to look at the rationale that they have given? Are we willing to look at what the enemy, Al-Qaeda, says that they organize things against the United States government? Are we willing to look at what they say is the reason that they have been attacking the United States? Do we even know what it is? No? Yeah. Well, very clearly, Al-Qaeda said back in the 90s, as they were blowing up the Khobar Towers in Saudi Arabia, as they blew up the three embassies in East Africa, as they blew up the USS Cole, the fact that the United States had left U.S. military in Saudi Arabia after 9/11, that was the primary cause. Also, the unequal treatment for Palestinians was another reason that that Al-Qaeda said they would be attacking U.S. interests. The war continues against Al-Qaeda. The global war on terror continues. The war against anyone, anywhere in the world continues for the United States. And I wonder, will we ever get to the point that we can say we kind of understand what happened? Can we ever forgive those who have killed Americans? I don't know. I don't know that it's within the reaches of our national psyche to do that. I don't know if Americans really forgive much. I think at this stage, and I guess it's reasonable in a way, while these things are so fresh in one's mind, so fresh in one's history, that it's difficult to think about a different way to respond to violence than any other way than with violence. Although one of the people that was on our trip to Vietnam did that. She was a wife of a man who was killed on one of the airplanes in 9/11. She's part of a group called Families for Peaceful Tomorrows. And this group of family members of people killed on 9/11 formed because there were several of them that said, I don't think a military response to what happened on 9/11 is going to resolve these issues, that we ought to really discuss a nonviolent way to resolve them. And this group formed Families for Peaceful Tomorrows. There are about 150 of the survivors of victims of 9/11 that are a part of this group. Certainly it's not the overwhelming majority of the people there. But it is to talk with someone whose family member was killed in 9/11 and have them say, we shouldn't take revenge, that we shouldn't retaliate in the same violent way that my husband was killed in, that we really do need to look at different ways, is a remarkable sentiment. She told us on this trip to Vietnam that she's lost many friends who were angry with her because she was not angry, that she was not lashing out, that she was not requiring, demanding violence for the death of her husband. So as we look at where we are in the world today, and as we look back at history in Vietnam, that we see the Vietnam government, the Vietnam people saying to America, even though we had 4 million people killed, we consider you friends now, that we've forgiven you and you need to forgive yourself. But don't do that to other people. Don't do that to other nations. That's what their appeal to us was. Don't do that to others. You know, while we were in Vietnam, it really strikes at your heart when you see the damages that are done by war. I mean, and having been in the military, I certainly knew the full scale of the explosive powers of these 2,000-pound bombs that we drop on people, and that the mortars that we sent, the grenades, the cluster bombs that the United States still uses, even in violation of international law. We have not signed the landmine treaty, nor have we signed the treaty against the use of cluster bombs. We still make cluster bombs and we sell them around the world as the U.S.'s greatest export, biggest export in for our country is weapons. That's our greatest export. So as we were in Vietnam and seeing the results of all of this ordnance that was dropped on the Vietnamese, we tried to offer our small little contribution to organizations that are working to help alleviate these problems. And Veterans for Peace over the last 20 years have had several projects in Vietnam. In fact, we have four members of Veterans for Peace who served in the U.S. military in Vietnam who are now living full-time in Vietnam to help monitor and be liaisons for these programs. The programs of helping people who have suffered the injuries from either Agent Orange or from unexploded ordnance. And some of the programs are pretty novel. They all help the families in some way as an income-generating project. And some of them are, I've never seen them quite this way before. One of them is growing mushrooms. Mushrooms on a large scale, mushrooms that farmers who have lost limbs because they've run into an unexploded ordnance, a grenade or a mortar or something, as they're doing their going through their fields, and you know these things still they pop up. They just as rains happen, then more things are the dirt, you know, somehow fades away, and all of a sudden this ordnance that may have been 2 or 3 feet below ground, all of a sudden it starts migrating upwards. And so the farmers, as they go through and plow or whatever, they hit these and get blown up. And so we met with one farmer who had one arm that had been blown off, and he was one of the mushroom farmers. And this it is an income-generating thing for a lot of people, where they have a factory that now puts sawdust into bags about this big, and the sawdust then has mushroom spores put into the bag. And then they line up, once they get the bags out to the farmer's place, they under a shed, they line up like 5 bags, string them up like this, and then over the next 3 months, the farmer waters this and whatever, and then at the end of it, all of a sudden, beautiful, wonderful mushrooms start coming out of these bags. And the mushrooms are part of the staple diet of the Vietnamese people, and the mushrooms are sold for a good price for the farmers. Another project that we have is helping with cattle raising. And for women who are women farmers who are getting into cattle raising. I mean, I was going, why did you pick cattle? Why is this project? I mean, because we know here in America, raising of cattle is an environmental mess, with the amount of water that it takes to water the cattle and to grow the feed and then the methane and all of this sort of stuff. And they said, well, first, it's not on the scale of America. It's one cow for one farmer. But to see these women that are back in the rural areas of Vietnam who now are able to generate income for their family through these projects that international groups are helping with was a way to alleviate some of the guilt, I think, that all of us felt for what had happened in Vietnam. A way to alleviate guilt for what had happened. So, you know, the issue of how we handle our national security, how we look toward those that we call our enemy now, how we maybe develop a long vision, if it's possible in these times of attacks. I think it's something that for us as Americans that we really need to do, because the propensity, I think, for our governments is to use the military as kind of, I wouldn't say the first instance, but it's one and a half. I mean, we are using our military way too frequently, in my opinion. And to help our government look toward different ways to approach our national security. I think our national security is actually jeopardized by many of the policies and the many of the tactics that various administrations have used, that indeed it's backfiring on our national security. And we as citizens having the responsibility, if we feel that way, to let our elected officials know about it. So this, the idea of making peace or peace after 9/11, restoring, healing after 9/11, looking back at Vietnam and seeing what happened there, and that people who have been attacked are then able to tell their attackers that we forgive you, that we are not going to hold this against you, but that we urge you, we counsel you to kind of look closely at yourself and see if there aren't better ways to resolve international issues. So I guess that's my message today. We look at 9/11 with very close up in our view, and then yet looking at Vietnam as a longer range of what the sentiments can be for those who have been attacked. So why don't I stop there and then offer an opportunity for you all to make your comments and questions. Thank you very much. Thank you.
Hi. Thank you so much for coming today. My name is Sabrina. I'm studying international relations, emphasizing in foreign relations and security. And I actually have a really, I have a question for you about your comment on why we can't forgive. And I learned this statistic yesterday that really astounded me. And it was that, you know, after 9/11, hate crimes against Muslims and Arab people in America has increased by 1,600%. And so I was wondering from that, and then from what you said today, how do we get our nation to first even just understand, you know, that it's not the Muslim people, you know, just to understand on the most basic level what's really going on and why they attacked us in the first place and who it really was, you know, as opposed to just this blind sort of hate that we still see over a decade later.
Mm-hmm. That's a very good comment and question. The issue of what the United States government did right after 9/11, the roundup of young Muslim men all over America was astounding, was horrifying. It certainly was reminiscent back 60 years before when the same type of thing happened to Japanese Americans. And ultimately, you know, 50 years later, an apology was given 50 years later. But to see what had happened to those Muslim American men, who many of them were locked up for months and months and months at a time, and still a roundup that is going on in certain cities for Muslim Americans, and what it's done to the Muslim American communities in the United States, where Muslim Americans are very hesitant about talking about where they come from, to join with groups, peace groups, and they will tell you, we're not getting on the radar. We know what the U.S. government has done to us in the last decade, and we're not about to in any way exercise our rights as American citizens to challenge any of this, because the vindictiveness is there, and very few people are standing up for us. Very few people are standing up for us. So it is indicative, I think, of a sentiment that tragically is throughout the fiber of some American communities. I mean, you see it not only in Muslim Americans, but you also see it for other minorities. The United States is not, it welcomes on one level people to come into the country, but on another level, there are a lot of Americans that are very suspicious and are not particularly welcoming to newcomers to their communities. And trying to bridge that big chasm is very difficult. And you look at the issue of the deportations of migrants that we have going on right now. Of course, the argument is on one level, on one side, well, they came in the country illegally. But then when you really look into a lot of the cases, maybe one came in illegally, but there are families that have been here for decades, and they are being deported. Children that have been born here that are American citizens and their parents are now being shipped out. So America is not as welcoming as we try to pretend it is. And it's something that we, I think, have to look deeply into ourselves about and work in every community to try to stamp down when we see hate crimes or hate speech or hate whatever it is occurring. And, you know, it's not just in the United States. I was in Asia last year, last fall, and went on a very interesting trip on a peace boat. Did you know that there is something called a peace boat in the world? It's not just a little tiny boat with 10 people on it for peace. This is a cruise liner that takes 1,000 people. And this peace boat has been circling the world for 30 years. And we haven't heard of it. But lots of people in the rest of the world have heard of it. It's run by a Japanese group, and it takes primarily Japanese, although we can sign up for it. It takes people around the world to go to conflict areas, to look and see what's going on. And I had been asked to speak in Japan on Article 9 of their constitution. You know, Article 9 is their no war article of their constitution. Almost 70 years after the end of World War II, when the United States wrote the Japanese Constitution for them, thank you very much, and we wrote in, you guys ain't going to do war no more. We put it in your Constitution. Well, now, it turns out, the United States would like to have a little more help on its wars. So both the Bush administration and the Obama administration have been encouraging the Japanese government to throw out that pesky little Article 9, that no-war provision, so that you can come and help us. Well, the Japanese people, though, they say, we kind of like that. It's kept us out of your wars. We haven't had any Japanese that were killed in Vietnam. We didn't have them killed in Central America. We didn't have them killed in Afghanistan. We didn't have them killed in Iraq. We don't want to join your wars. That's what the people are saying. So they asked me, and along with quite a few other internationals, to come to talk about the need to keep that type of article in their constitution. While I was there, the peace boat was taking a cruise in Northeast Asia because of hate speech. Hate speech in Japan against Koreans. Koreans who had lived in Japan for decades. Koreans that had been brought by the Imperial Army of Japan into Japan to be slave laborers. And yet the family stayed after World War II. And the Japanese, some Japanese, they don't like to have those foreigners there. So it's not just in the United States that this is happening, but it's like the peace boat taking a cruise of 500 South Koreans, 500 Japanese, and going around Northeast Asia in 10 days to give these groups time to talk to each other about how they and their communities can tamp down this hate idea that's going on there. So it's something I think we have to, in our communities, we have to talk about, we have to recognize it, and we have to support the groups that are being the targets of this hate speech. Thank you. Thanks.
Hi, my name's Josh, and I'm a behavioral sciences major. Thank you for coming today.
Thank you.
Just wanted to ask, touching more on the NSA, as it's come more into the public eye and it's gained a lot of scrutiny, as I've read about it and looked more into it, it seems like it's a big conglomerate of information. It's really hard to, like, pick things out. they have keywords and different things that they can, you know, recognize. But other than that, if they don't know exactly what they're looking for, they don't really know what they're looking at because there's so much information. And then I just kind of relate that back to, you know, law enforcement before the NSA. And you see, of course, they have interests. They have keywords. They have, you know, they're tapping lines as well. So this has been going on for a long time. With population growing, with technology advancing, it seems almost inevitable that we need to have something like this as a national security issue. I love peace, and so I have nothing against that motive. But I think that the NSA is important. What would you have to say about that?
Well, I think there is a role for the NSA. But I don't think its role, in my opinion, is not to do mass collection for storage, and then at the political will. I mean, it may not be national security. It may be politics. It may be retribution for individuals that one particular political group doesn't like. It may be individuals. You know, the FBI got in big trouble in 2004 and 5 because of the Patriot Act, the need for intelligence, the need to suspend the rules, suspend the way that the federal law enforcement agencies normally do business, which is if they need to get your bank records, if they need to get your cell phone records to find out because they have a reasonable suspicion that you've been doing something illegal. And it's illegal. I mean, a criminal act. It's not your political views. I mean, that's McCarthyism that we thought we had tapped down 50 years ago. But it turned out that and FBI agents were given the authority under the Patriot Act to, on their own signature, to demand records from banks, cell phone companies, anything they wanted just by their signature. Normally, they had to go to a court. And a judge had to look at the evidence the FBI had and say, you do have a reasonable suspicion that this person has committed a criminal act, and they sign off on a search warrant. Doesn't take a lot of time because there are these courts that are set up in every federal jurisdiction, and there's a judge that's identified 24 hours a day that they can look at this, sign off on it, and immediately the FBI can go do whatever they need to do under the law. But under the Patriot Act, it was the individual FBI's agent's signature. Well, it started turning out that, maybe I want to find out what my ex-wife's bank account's like. Or my girlfriend, I have a little suspicion she might be doing something, and I'd like to find her cell phone records, see who she's been calling. And it became so rampant within the FBI, this abuse of that power, that the FBI agents were talking about it over the water fountain. Everybody knew who was being, you know, what they were doing. And finally, the Inspector General of the FBI, I guess, was at the water fountain one day and heard all of this. And there were congressional hearings, actually, that started taking place because they were getting complaints from constituents that ultimately heard from somebody that their records had been taken. You know, normally the FBI, once the bank is notified by the FBI, they can't notify you and me that you're under suspicion. Just like the librarians under the Patriot Act, librarians who were asked who's been checking out books on this, that, and the other thing, they were supposed to tell who's been checking it out, but you can't tell anybody that you've been asked this. And the librarians were the first group to say, that's wrong. And they went public saying, the FBI is telling us we have to submit all this information. Well, so what happened? The Congress had their investigation on it, and the FBI was sorely embarrassed on it, and that part of the Patriot Act was closed up. So I'm saying that the potential for abuse is very, very high. For political reasons, and for reasons it's hard to imagine what devious little things might come up. But when you've got this big, huge amount of data that it only takes, and you mentioned keywords. Well, they've got keywords upon keywords upon keywords upon keywords that can narrow this thing down very, very quickly. So I personally am very, very concerned about it, and I think we... as citizens whose right to privacy is part of our constitutional legacy, that we should really challenge this. Thank you. And before we go on to another question, I just wanted to mention, I wrote a book about 5 years ago. It's called Dissent, Voices of Conscience, and it's about men and women of our government, both in the military, State Department, FBI, and other agencies, NSA, who have challenged our government on a variety of issues since 9/11, on the issues of torture, on the issues of extraordinary rendition, on the issues of eavesdropping, on the legality of wars. And it's the stories of what happened to these folks as they did what they did. For example, how did we even find out about what was going on, the torture that was going on in Abu Ghraib? Do you even know how that popped on our radar screen, that we finally saw the photos of all those people being naked, stacked on top of each other? It was because of an Army specialist, Joe Darby, who some of his buddies worked down in that wing of Abu Ghraib prison. They brought some photos to him one day, said, "You want to see what we do on Saturday night with those prisoners? Take a look at this." And Joe Darby looked at the CD with all these pictures and was horrified. Horrified about what was going on. And he's the one that called in the Army's Criminal Investigative Division, and they started investigating, and ultimately it was Donald Rumsfeld. I don't know if you remember this. On TV, Donald Rumsfeld gave a press conference saying, "Yes, we do know now that we have some problems down in this prison in Abu Ghraib, and we're all investigating, and we have to thank Specialist Joe Darby for this." Well, Joe Darby was still at Abu Ghraib prison when Rumsfeld made this. He was sitting in the mess hall of the prison and with some of the guys that had actually given him the photos. And Joe Darby, the rat, Joe Darby, "We're going to kill you." Joe Darby, who now is in federal protective custody, who had to change his name because he knew what was right to do. That it was right that it be exposed, what the actions were of his fellow soldiers. And it's stories like that that we have preserved because they need to be remembered. We need to remember that it's tough sometimes to tell, to challenge your government. It was tough for me to resign, but I could resign without consequences. But other people challenge the government and they've ended up in jail over it. So the bottom line, though, it's our responsibility to do it. It's our country, and if we want our country to act in ways that we think are proper and right, then, and if we see that there's a deviation from that, then it's our responsibility to challenge it. Other questions or comments?
Hi, I'm David, and just ask that you give us a few examples or a couple of the top ones of the U.S. Military action that you said really backfired on our foreign policy.
Mm-hmm. Well, if you look at the recent ones of the last 10 years, I think the invasion and occupation of Iraq backfired big time. I mean, if you look at the credibility of the United States in the eyes of countries around the world, the invasion and occupation of Iraq was castigated by, I would say, 98% of the countries of the world, the ones that weren't part of the coalition of the willing. The issue of torture, the issue of extraordinary rendition, of kidnapping people and flying them all around the world to torture, to be tortured for information. The issue of assassin drones. Of the United States targeting, extrajudicially killing people to include three Americans. I think that's backfired on the United States. Essentially, if you listen to our presidents and as they start backtracking, that's where you see that they've gotten enough flack from their own constituents, us, as well as other countries of the world about what America's been doing. But I would say that the last 10 years have not, the actions of the United States government have not enhanced the reputation of the United States at all.
Please join me in thanking Anne for an excellent and informative forum.
Thank you. Thanks.